John 7 from verse 1. After this, Jesus went about in Galilee. He would not go about in Judea because the Jews were seeking to kill him. Now the Jews' feast of booths was at hand. So his brothers said to him, "Leave here and go to Judea, that your disciples also may see the works that you are doing. For no one works in secret if he seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." For not even his brothers believed in him. Jesus said to them, "My time has not yet come, but your time is always here. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me, because I testify about it that its works are evil. You go up to the feast. I'm not going up to this feast, for my time has not yet fully come." After saying this, he remained in Galilee. But after his brothers had gone up to the feast, then he also went up, not publicly, but in private. The Jews were looking for him at the feast and saying, "Where is he?" And there was much muttering about him among the people. While some said, "He's a good man," others said, "No, he's leading the people astray." Yet for fear of the Jews, no one spoke openly of him. Do keep that open. And on the inside of these sheets as well, there's some headings which will be a help to us as we look at it. The theme of this whole section of John that we're in at the moment is really all about unbelief. It's about people rejecting Jesus. It's actually expanding on the theme which was raised right at the beginning in chapter 1, verse 11. He came to his own, that's speaking of Jesus, coming to his own people, and his own did not receive him. And this is explaining how that happened. And we've headed each one of these messages from now to Christmas, "Why I Can't Believe." And today the objection we're going to be considering, it's up on the screens, "Why I Can't Believe Christianity is So Negative." And I put on the sheets, why does Christianity have to be so negative? I wonder if you've got this issue yourself. Perhaps you've looking into the faith. If that's you, you're very welcome. Each week there's people who have little background and just putting their head around the door, and we're glad you found us. And there's lots for you perhaps that's attractive about the Christian faith. You like Jesus and his life and his example. You like the idea of knowing God as Father. You like the idea of a hope beyond death and so on. But why do Christians have to then go and spoil it all that awkward stuff? The negative bits, the bits like sin and judgment, the narrow bits like Jesus being the only way to God, the restrictive bits like the do's and don'ts of how to live. Or maybe you're here as a convinced believer, as many of us will be, and you're asking the question from the perspective of, why is it that Christians are so negative, especially Christian leaders, Christian spokespeople, when they could, we think, present the faith much more positively, more winsomely. Maybe you think, what a breath of fresh air it is when denominational leaders stay off those difficult, contentious subjects and instead major on those areas where the Bible is in tune with the culture. Why can't Christians be known for what they're for? Compassion, standing with the marginalized, rather than always what they're against. You know, if only Christians were a little bit more PR savvy in how to promote our product, then surely everything would be solved and people would be gushing into the church. Well, perhaps surprisingly, a very similar conversation was going on in Jesus' day, and we just had the verses read. Jesus' younger brothers were very PR savvy, and they were very keen, as younger brothers often want to give their older siblings advice, I know in my family, they were very keen to help their older brother out. Let's have a look. Verse 2, we'll pick it up. Now the Jews' feast of booths was at hand. The Feast of Booths, or Tabernacles, is one of the three major annual festivals for the Jewish people, along with Passover and Pentecost. And people from all over the country went up to the capital, to Jerusalem, to the temple. And Jesus' brothers know this is coming, and they have this excellent idea. Look at verse 3. So his brothers said to him, "Leave here and go to Judea." That's where Jerusalem is, the capital. "That your disciples also may see the works," that is the miracles, "that you are doing. For no one works in secret if he seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world. Jesus, what you should do is take your miracles, they're the positive bit, everyone loves the miracles, and no one denies how amazing they are. Take your miracles and get to the big smoke. Get to the capital, go there at festival time, everyone's there. If you want to make it big, that's the strategy. And it sounds, doesn't it, as you explain it, pretty logical. It's good advice, it seems. And then verse 5 comes as a big shock to us. Do you notice that? For not even his brothers believed in him. We weren't expecting that. Here we discover, and I've put number 1 there on your sheets, it is possible to be pro-Jesus and yet still not truly believe. Verse 5 does seem strange to us because we've just heard, haven't we, that Jesus' brothers believe that Jesus' miracles are real. In fact, it's worth knowing that no one in Jesus' day thought otherwise, that no one doubted the reality of Jesus' miracles, although there was a lot of discussion about where the power was coming from. And we've heard that Jesus' brothers are totally pro-Jesus. They want his success. We've heard that. They're trying to encourage and promote Jesus' influence. And yet then we get this shock verse. Verse 5 says that they don't truly believe. Their faith, whatever it is, what their pro-Jesusness is not real faith. And actually this is important if we'd been reading through John's gospel as we have been, although we had a big gap, because it shines a light on what has been happening in the gospel so far. Up until now there seem to be two very different responses to Jesus. There's the urban Judean response, and there's been the rural Galilean response. And John's reminded us of this whole issue there in verse 1. Verse 1, after this, Jesus went about in Galilee, that's up north, amongst the country folk with their thick provincial accents, that's where Jesus grew up. But he would not go about in Judea. Do you remember, that's the south where Jerusalem is, where all the urban elites hang out, because the Jews were seeking to kill him. Now, back in chapter 5, and we looked at this, Jesus was amongst the urban types. He was in Jerusalem. He did a dramatic healing, and he made a claim about his identity. And very quickly, he is charged with blasphemy, and the people there want him killed. Whereas, it was a big contrast, in chapter 6, Jesus was up north in Galilee, and he did another dramatic miracle, not a healing this time, but miraculously feeding a crowd of thousands, multiplying bread and fish, and they responded not by wanting to kill Jesus, but by wanting to make him king. Do you see the contrast? And we were wondering, is it just that country folk are a little bit more spiritually in tune than city dwellers? And I understand in present company, you don't want that to be what the Bible's teaching. You know, we want to say, no, we're okay, we're city dwellers are fine. And John agrees with us. The answer is no. Yes, there are these two groups. One of them feels threatened by Jesus' miracles. They want him stopped. The other is excited about Jesus' miracles. They want them to be more public, like the brothers. But despite these different symptoms, here we see that what characterizes both of these groups, to remember the anti-Jesus and the pro-Jesus groups, is the same disease. They've got the same underlying problem, and it is unbelief. There's a picture of a kind of stubborn, unbelieving kind of person. It's possible to be pro-Jesus, but still not truly believe. And as I say that, I hope for a lot of us that should be very unsettling. I hope for a lot of us we're sitting up in our seats and thinking, I've got to take notice. This is serious. From the moment that Mary the First, that's Bloody Mary, was declared Queen of England in 1554, the first priority for her was to produce a child, an heir. 12 months later, aged 38, she was married to King Philip of Spain, and after a couple of false alarms, she announced in 1557 that she was pregnant. As the days went on, her bump grew, but it was only when the child was due to be born that she and the rest of Europe, who were eagerly awaiting this child, realized there was no child. And it's now considered that Mary's symptoms were most likely caused, in fact, by cancer, probably cancer of the ovaries or the uterus. tragically, what was thought to be the sign of life in Mary, this growing bump, was in fact the sign of death, and she died the next year. And that must have been a terrible realization for her. But it would be no less terrible for someone to be pro-Jesus and to think that we have true faith, signs of spiritual life in us, and only to discover too late that it was actually bogus, it was fake, it was counterfeit all along, and that we were still actually living in death and under God's judgment. And I say this, I hope, therefore, all of us want to read on and discover what is going on. John's kind of teasing us in with this puzzle. What were the brothers lacking in this? And the reason Jesus gives for why his brothers managed to be pro-Jesus and yet still not truly believing, this is point number two, is because truly believing in Jesus will involve accepting the world's hate. Look again, verse 6. Jesus said to them, "My time has not yet come, but your time is always here. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me, because I testify about it that its works are evil. You go up to the feast, but I'm not going up to this feast, for my time has not yet fully come." And the first thing Jesus makes crystal clear in these verses, and I've put it on the sheets, is that Jesus' message will always be hated by this world. Now, the first time I came across Christians, this was at uni, who talked in this kind of way about the world hating Jesus, I have to say, I thought that they were very paranoid. I thought that they were just kind of grumpy sort of people who were unnecessarily negative about humanity. You see, I'd grown up in church, and I'd had opportunities to speak of my faith at various times, and I'd spoken to people about God in the past and about how God loves everybody and that he has a wonderful plan for all of our lives if only we accept him. And I hadn't found any real problem. Obviously, a lot of people had found that unpersuasive or irrelevant, but there wasn't really any hostility to what I was saying. But as I came to understand more accurately what Jesus really taught, what his message really is, and started to speak about that, I quickly discovered that the hostility was and is very real. And if we are faithful to what Jesus really teaches, the hatred actually can be pretty intense. Look at verse 7. "The world cannot hate you, but it hates me." Jesus says it. The world hates him. And why? Well, here's Jesus' answer. "Because I testify about it that its works are evil." There's a key scene in, if you've seen the Superman Returns film, this is a while back, where Superman's father is sending Superman to Earth. And his father says to him, "Live as one of them. They can be a great people. They wish to be. They only lack the light to show the way. For this reason above all, their capacity for good, I have sent them you, my only son." And you can hear in that statement, I think, a deliberate parallel to Jesus and how many people understand the message of Jesus Christ. But actually, the message of Jesus is very different from the message that the makers of Superman think. Jesus has not come as a helper. He's not come to show a good humanity how to get just that little bit better. No, as chapter 4 told us, and we looked at this, verse 42, Jesus has come as Savior. Because, and we saw this in chapter 3, verse 36, without Jesus, humanity lives under God's anger. Humanity desperately needs saving. And that message is always going to be humbling. It will be hated by proud people who don't think they need a savior. And this, incidentally, is why the PR savvy approach is not going to be the answer. So even if a denominational leader were to get some positive headlines about the faith, and even if there were an increased positivity towards the Jesus brand in this country, Jesus is explaining here in verse 7 that kind of positivity will collapse as soon as Jesus' real message is heard. Sadly, in fact, people do fill churches that way. And you'll have probably come across it here in London. You can easily find a church with a Jesus as your helper or Jesus as your life coach sort of teaching. And actually, that should not surprise us. What was striking to me looking at it again this week, that word "for" at the beginning of verse 5. The brothers said all this stuff, for they didn't believe. So that word "for" tells us that one of the ways unbelief will express itself, perhaps this is a surprise to us, is by lots of people getting on board with the Jesus brand and promoting Jesus. This is exactly what unbelief will do. But the Jesus they promote will be changed. He will have been photoshopped beyond recognition. He'll have had all the sharp angles taken off him so that he's completely inoffensive to the prevailing culture. So please, and I know this is a time of year, some people in this room will be church hunting or you've got friends around the country who are. Please encourage them to be discerning, not just to ask, well, was Jesus proclaimed and spoken about? But ask which Jesus was proclaimed in that church. Was it Jesus, the social justice warrior? Was it Jesus, the wonder worker who will fix your problems? Was it Jesus, the ecumenical peacemaker who can unite anyone, so long as we don't ask too many questions about what we're uniting around? And sadly, there are any number of photoshopped Jesuses to choose from. And unless it is the real Jesus who is proclaimed, the Jesus presented to us in the scriptures, the one Savior from God's judgment, then it will all be froth with no substance to it. You see, many people, when they first discover the salvation which Jesus offers, they tell anyone and everyone who will listen. Perhaps that was your experience. You just bubbled over everywhere you went. You know, why wouldn't anyone and everyone be thrilled by this news that has so transformed us? That's what we think. And then we pretty quickly discover a much frostier reception, perhaps, than we were expecting. And so many people conclude that they're just not very good at this talking about their faith thing, and they dry up and give up. And if that's been your experience, please can I encourage you not to be discouraged. Jesus tells us that is normal experience. He tells us to expect a frosty reception from some, but that shouldn't be a shock or a discouragement to us, because others, and we'll see this elsewhere in John's gospel, there's be others in whom God is at work, and they will hear and believe, and they will bear dramatic fruit in their lives. So don't be discouraged. So where have we got to? Jesus has clarified, hasn't he? There are basically two camps that we can side with in this life. Just in Jesus' words, they are team world and team Jesus. And he's been telling us that no amount of clever PR, no amount of papering over the cracks is ever going to change that harsh reality. But the next disturbing thing Jesus clarifies to these brothers is that there is no middle ground. There can be no middle ground. As I put on the sheets, our default position is on the world's side. Let's see if you can tease out from Jesus' statement which team Jesus' brothers are actually on. It's there in verses 6 to 8. Let me read. Jesus said to the brothers, "My time has not yet come, but your time is always here. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me, because I testify about it that its works are evil. You go up to the feast. I'm not going up to this feast, for my time has not yet fully come." Did you notice it there? The world cannot hate the brothers, and that is because, despite being pro-Jesus, they haven't decisively switched teams. They're actually still on team world. Because clearly, if they had switched teams to team Jesus, Jesus makes it clear they would be starting to receive the same response from the world that Jesus gets. So please don't think there can be a kind of middle way. You know, if only we could be charming enough, if only we could be trained enough in answers to all the difficult questions, if only we were more winsome, more smiley perhaps, if we can somehow, if we could do all those things, manage to be faithful to Christ and loved by the world. Don't believe it. I read a Guardian interview recently with the actor Stephen Baldwin. He's the youngest of the Baldwin brothers. He was in films like The Usual Suspects. And then after 9/11, he had a very dramatic conversion to Christ, and he's now a very outspoken Christian. And in this interview, this Guardian journalist clearly found him very likable. And she wrote this: Stephen Baldwin is a character. Even his tattoos are bananas. He's a pumped-up ball of energy, a glitter-eyed alpha male, a proper laugh. He charms everyone that wanders into his light. And then as the interview draws to a close, she probes him about whether he holds to the Bible on sexual ethics. And the article ends on a different note. And so Stephen and I part company, both feeling disappointed in each other. It's a shame, but it's one of those things. You can really like someone, but when you disagree so decisively, you can never really be friends. Honestly, what is it about born-again Christians that makes them so intolerant? And that's the cliffhanger, that's the climax of the article. Now, I doubt that there are many of us in this room who will ever be as charming or as winsome as this guy, Stephen Baldwin. But do you see, it makes precious little difference. Because if we are faithful to Jesus, if we're faithful to what he teaches, we will be treated the way he was. And I say this because I want you to be forewarned. It's interesting, actually, only, I think it's half an hour ago, as I was coming in, Nathan was on the gate stewarding with a high-vis jacket, and he got into a conversation with an atheist guy who is a social historian who'd stopped his bike because he saw a sign saying church, and he wanted to give Nathan a piece of his mind about what he thought about Christians and how if this thing were allowed to continue, this culture would go back to regressive times and we'd lose all our rights. And it was just a little reminder, knowing what's coming in the sermon, that it is often going to be the case that being loyal to Jesus is not going to win us friends. And Nathan was doing a great job, and I think many of us will have had that kind of experience. You can try and push back with certain things, but it's not going to win points. For most of my school career, I was the only Christian believer in my year, but there were a few years, I think a couple of years in the middle, where I was very lucky to have another Christian, and conveniently, he was called Christian. And he was very public about his faith, and he lived very distinctively, so much so, actually, that he got quite badly teased. He was very careful to be pure in what he spoke about, which actually really stands out in a boys' school and for a teenage guy. Every day, therefore, the gang of friends that I was part of would make great sport out of trying to get Christian to accidentally say something vulgar. It was basically the game all day long, every day. And other times, people in the group would sellotape him to his chair for entire lessons, so he couldn't put up his hand, he couldn't write anything down. And he was such a lovely guy that he never told on anyone, and he never wanted to get anyone in trouble. He just sucked it up. And I look back on that period with real shame, actually. You see, I was much cooler than Christian was. I'd worked out the strategy, and I knew all the ways that I had to blend in so that I got no trouble at all for my faith. And I've been looking at this passage this week, and I've been thinking about those years, and I now look back and I wonder, according to the Bible's definitions, I wonder to what extent my faith was a real faith in those days. You see, these verses show that truly believing in Jesus will involve siding with Jesus to the extent that we start to be treated the way he was treated. And it raises the question for me, at least, had I really switched? Was I still on Team World, or had I yet switched to Team Jesus? Was I actually still like one of these brothers? Pro-Jesus, of course, but not quite ready to side with him if it's going to mean some cost. So these verses clarify, don't they, that one of the chief characteristics of unbelief, and it can be the pro-Jesus kind or the anti-Jesus kind, one of the chief characteristics is being motivated by human approval. For the Jerusalem leaders, they're pursuing human approval through opposing Jesus, aren't they? Jesus' message threatens their position, their power base, their influence, and therefore they want to get rid of him. Whereas for the brothers, they're pursuing human approval through promoting Jesus. They want to get some kind of reflected glory off the back of his success. But do you see that for both groups, it's the same problem. Their love of the world's approval, we discover, makes them unable to truly believe. We saw back in chapter 5, verse 44, it's a very chilling verse. Jesus says this, "How can you believe when you receive glory from one another and do not seek the glory that comes from the only God?" Let me read it again. Chapter 5, 44. "How can you believe when you receive glory from one another and do not seek the glory that comes from the only God?" I guess we have all of us seen in our lives the effects, haven't we, of peer pressure. That's a pretty extreme and devastating example of it. You know, there's that just one guy who's not taken in by it. But the effects, the damaging effects of peer pressure are everywhere. And I'm not just thinking about teenagers at the back of the class who are more interested in showing off to their mates than in doing what the teacher wants. I guess nearly all of us here will have seen it in adult life as well, where in a professional context, the people in the team are more focused on boosting their own image than in following the team leader's strategy or doing the best job they can. And I guess we all know how destructive this kind of tendency is. And we need to be aware that this same dynamic is alive on a spiritual level. Only on a spiritual level, it is much more deadly. And the person I think who understood and wrote about this tendency most penetratingly is C.S. Lewis. This summer I read his novel on this topic. It's called That Hideous Strength, and it's a novel-length examination of this idea. But if you don't want to read the whole novel, all the ideas in it are conveniently in one brilliant essay called The Inner Ring, and you can find it online, and I really recommend giving it a read. And in the essay, Lewis writes this, "I believe that in all men's lives at certain periods, one of the most dominant elements is the desire to be inside the local ring and the terror of being left outside." He says, of all the passions, the passion for the inner ring, being in that inner group, is most skillful in making a man who is not yet a very bad man do very bad things. And here we're discovering that this inclination to be accepted affects every one of us. And without a miracle, without God's intervention, this tendency will make us spiritually blind and unable to think clearly or believe rightly. And so for each of us in this room, whether we're strongly anti-Jesus or strongly pro-Jesus, this passage asks us the same question. Is what is really driving me in life human affirmation? If we are anti-Jesus, is it possible that our resistance to Jesus and his claims is really being driven by the fear of what others might think, perhaps professional or social disapproval? Actually, I had a friend who's looking into Christian things. At the end of it all, she told me she simply couldn't believe. And the reason she gave was that becoming a Christian would effectively be announcing to her whole family that they were wrong about their lives and priorities, and she was not prepared to do that. Or for those of us who are pro-Jesus, like these brothers, if someone examined our lives in detail, would they conclude that we are ultimately being driven by God's approval or by human approval? Can we even think of the last time we acted in a way that had some cost to our reputations or to our advancement simply because of our greater loyalty for God? Because if not, there is a real danger for us that we might be like one of these brothers, and that this addiction to human approval is actually holding us back from true belief. This is a sobering teaching, and this passage ends with the tragic implication of this principle on a big societal scale. I put there point three, namely that therefore many people remain in unbelief out of fear. Let's pick it up, verse 10. "But after his brothers had gone up to the feast, Then Jesus also went up, not publicly, but in private. Incidentally, there's no suggestion that Jesus was therefore lying back in verse 8 when he said, I'm not going to the feast. That's because the Greek present tense in verse 8 can have the sense, I'm not going now. Therefore, Jesus wasn't necessarily ruling out going later. I'll throw that in if that was a question for you. Anyway, verse 11, the Jews were looking for him at the feast and saying, where is he? And this phrase, the Jews, refers specifically to the Jerusalem leaders, the ones back in verse 1, do you remember, who are trying to kill Jesus, and they're on the prowl in Jerusalem. The Jews were looking for him at the feast, saying, where is he? Verse 12, and there was much muttering about him among the people. While some said, he's a good man, others said, no, he's leading the people astray. So it's interesting, at this stage at least, that the people at large haven't yet got a fixed opinion about Jesus. They're divided, they're confused. And then comes this tragic verse, verse 13. Yet for fear of the Jews, no one spoke openly of him. Isn't that devastating? What is keeping these people in unbelief is not some clever philosophical objection. It's not that they've evaluated the evidence for Jesus and his claims and they somehow found it wanting. It's simply that, we see it in that verse, they're scared. They don't want to risk being out of step with the inner ring. They don't want to risk being on the wrong side of the smart people, the elite, the movers and shakers. And so they miss out on the salvation and life that Jesus has come to bring. Please don't make this same mistake. There may be some in this room, and you are holding back from Christian things because you know if it's convincing and you worry that it might be, there will be a cost to you, to your reputation, to your relationships. And if you think that, you're right. There will be. But what a tragedy to count human opinion which is so fickle and so fleeting, ultimately. What a tragedy to put more store by human opinion than your Creator's opinion. What a tragedy to miss out ultimately on the relationship that we were made for, to miss out on the unending life God longs to give us. So please do not make this same mistake. I'm aware that perhaps for quite a few of us, we're aware that this passage has been unsettling. Perhaps it has exposed our problem, and yet we're still not sure exactly what the solution is. Perhaps we think, you know, if only I could flick a switch and suddenly be free from all my fears, but it's not that easy. And I think that's true. We can't do it, and we do need divine help. I don't want to actually steal the thunder of what's coming later in this chapter. You'll have to keep coming back. But I do want to draw out just one of the little rays of hope, even from within our verses. There is a solution which comes from outside of us. There is a resourcing which God will provide. And there's a hint of it even here in verse 8. I wonder if you notice. Jesus says, you go up to the feast. I'm not going up to this feast, Jesus says. Why? For my time has not yet fully come. It's a little hint, isn't it? Something is on the horizon. And as we go on in John's Gospel, there is a moment at another feast, the final Passover, when Jesus will say in chapter 12, it's here, my time has now fully come. And later, even in this chapter, chapter 7:39, we're going to see that Jesus, once he has died and risen, he promises to provide an empowering that we desperately need, his Holy Spirit. He will enable people to stand for him against a hostile world. So please don't leave here thinking you're desperate. There's no chance. There is hope. Please come back and discover more about the resources God gives us. And actually, even in what could be, I think, a potentially depressing note for us to end on, this heading, therefore, many people remain in unbelief out of fear. I think even in this, there is actually an encouragement for us if we're believers. You see, the temptation for us is to see the way in our society that Jesus is ignored, see the way he's sidelined, perhaps in our university, in our workplace, in parliament, in the public square generally, and we conclude that maybe the evidence for Jesus isn't as strong as we thought it was. I mean, do any of the smart people seem to take him seriously, we think? And we just gradually lose confidence. And this passage reminds us not to be intimidated. You see, Jesus says elsewhere that there is going to be a day when everyone will take Jesus seriously. They'll have to. And as these chapters are going to show us again and again, the reasons why Jesus is rejected back then and today are actually not rational reasons at all. And they can be largely be traced back to such silly things as prejudice and fear, as we're going to see. So please, don't be discouraged. This is actually a reason for us to keep going and to keep standing boldly for Jesus, even when it's very, very difficult.